This is the book Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smylie, the story of the Scottish Church in the years of persecution. This is a wonderful story, the story of the Covenanters, and not only is it good for us to remember those who went before us who suffered greatly for the faith, but it also is instructive to us. As we face probable, almost certain persecution in days to come, we can learn a lot from these men and women who suffered and loved not their lives unto the death in the service of the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, this is a relatively long section, the prologue to the book. I expect it to be very good, very heartening, very encouraging, very moving. And I'm hoping to do live broadcasts of the subsequent chapters, but this one, because of its length, is perhaps not so suitable for a live broadcast. But without further ado, prologue, Smylie's Covenanters. The Covenanters were the men and women who uttered the strongest convictions of their souls in two great documents of the 17th century, a heroic period in the history of Britain. One of these documents is the National Covenant of Scotland, as it was recast and sworn in 1638. The other is the Solemn League and Covenant, similar in aspiration, but wider in geographical scope, being designed to embrace England and Ireland as well as the smaller country north of the Cheviots and the Solway. In this book, there is no intention of depicting the events and persons of the generation in which these famous confessions sprang into existence. It begins with the Annus Mirabilis of the Restoration, when the National Covenant was 22 springtimes old, and when some who were prominent in commending it, to their fellows had passed from the scene of their earthly battle. Its concern is with the characters and the doings and the sorrows of their immediate successors, who coincided with them in intellectual belief and in spiritual enthusiasm. It will attempt once more to describe the features of an age when, in Scotland, the conflict was even more keenly waged and the tragedy had become darker and more lurid. But if we are to understand the later epoch, it will be necessary at the outset to recall a few of the incidents in the earlier. It is inevitable that we should make our initial pilgrimage to the churchyard of the Grey Friars in Edinburgh. Charles I was in some respects the best of the Stuarts. He was free from the childishness of his father, that pompous and solemn father who was deeply learned without possessing useful knowledge, a lover of negotiations in which he was always outwitted, fond of his dignity while he was perpetually degrading it by undue familiarity, laborious in trifles and a trifler where serious labour was required, the wisest fool in Christendom. He had none of the ribald licence of the son who followed him on the throne, nor of the saturnine malignity of the other son who had scarcely grasped the reins of power when he was compelled to lay them down. But less than either James VI or Charles II, he understood how to govern his people. To the last degree, he was opinionative and despotic. So you had these four kings, James I, Charles I, Charles II, and James II throughout the covenanting era. And in between Charles I and Charles II, you had the time when Cromwell was in power. And all of this had a great effect on Scottish history. But less than either James VI or Charles II, he understood how to govern his people to the last degree. He was opinionative and despotic. He would not bate a jot of his divine right. Never for a moment was he disposed to listen to the voices of sound reason and popular liberty. In Scotland especially, he rode roughshod over the convictions of his subjects, even although with a persistent and pathetic loyalty, they were ready to shed every drop of their blood in his defence. Matters reached a crisis on that historic Sabbath on the 23rd of July in 1637, when the new liturgy, which the King and Archbishop Laud had gifted to a nation furled to Calvinistic Presbyterianism, was to be read in the Church of St. Giles. For those of you who followed my preaching in Scotland, I preached outside of St. Giles a couple of months back. Dean Hannah was not permitted to use the Popish English Scottish Mass Service Book. He and Bishop Lindsay and the authorities in London and Canterbury had not calculated on Jenny Geddes and her compeers. At last, the Scots were in a white heat of indignation. I think he's going to sound this, maybe it isn't, but Jenny Geddes was the one who picked up the stool she was sitting on and threw it at the Dean's head, saying, "You'll not preach popery in my lug, or you won't preach the Pope in my ear." There was a watershed. "Are we so modest spirits?" writes Robert Bailey, and he was himself among the more pliable of the ministers of the Kirk. "And are we so towardly handled that there is an appearance we shall embrace in a clap such a mass of novelties? The one plea which may be urged for the sovereign and little lord is that they had a totally inadequate conception of the intensity of religious feeling in Scotland. They lived in a fool's paradise, like the French officer in Alphonse Daudet's story, who up to the very day when the Germans entered Paris dreamed that it was Prussia which was going down in the cataclysm of 1870. Lord Clarendon tells us how profoundly indifferent the English people and their leaders were in those years to everything which happened on the farther side of the Tweed." That means in Scotland. The north of the Tweed was Scotland and the south of the Tweed was England. "When the whole nation was solicitous to know what passed weekly in Germany and Poland and all other parts of Europe, no man ever inquired what was doing in Scotland, nor had the kingdom a place or mention of one page of any gazette. It was a silly and culpable ignorance, and the awakening was to be swift and stern. For it was out of the peril in which the Scottish nation found itself that there came the renewal of the national covenant. Two men, whose names are written bright across the annals of the time, planned this renewal. Archibald Johnston of Warriston, the young advocate of the Edinburgh courts, and Alexander Henderson, foremost and most statesmanlike of the Presbyterian clergymen of the day. Between them they framed the momentous charter. It consisted of three portions. The first was a reproduction of an older covenant, the King's Confession of 1581. The second enumerated the various acts of the Scottish Parliament, which condemned popery and confirmed the privileges of the Reformed Church. The third was a grave and emphatic protest against those alien modes of worship which had provoked the present troubles. Warriston was author of the second portion, Henderson of the third. We may hearken to the accents of this Magna Carta of offended presbytery, because its writers say we plainly perceive and undoubtedly believe that the innovations and evils contained in our supplications, complaints, and protestations have no warrant of the word of God, are contrary to the articles of our confession, to the intention and meaning of the blessed reformers of religion of this land, to the above written acts of Parliament, and do sensibly tend to the re-establishing of the Popish religion and tyranny, and to the subversion and ruin of the true Reformed religion. Those wanting more information can go and listen to the history of John Knox by Thomas McCree, DD, which has been serialised in an audiobook and can be found on Sermon Audio. So let's go back to that again. And to the subversion and ruin of the true Reformed religion and of our liberties, laws and estates. Therefore, from the knowledge and conscience of our duty to God, to our King and country, without any worldly respect or inducement, so far as human infirmity will suffer, wishing a further measure of the grace of God for this effect, we promise and swear by the great name of the Lord our God to continue in the profession and obedience of the aforesaid religion, and that we shall defend the same and resist all these contrary errors and corruptions according to our vocation, and to the uttermost of that power that God hath put in our hands all the days of our life. Here is a trumpet which gives no uncertain sound, but the covenanters were careful also that there should not be the slightest diminution in the reverence they yielded to the monarch. On the contrary, they avow, we promise and swear that we shall, to the utmost of our power, with our means and lives, stand to the defence of our dread sovereign. Surely it was a criminal short-sightedness which drove into opposition citizens so loyal. In the churchyard of the Greyfriars, where once the monastery of the Franciscans had stood, you can visit that churchyard, highly recommended, because you have the place where the covenant has signed the covenant, and you have the place also behind that, the Covenanter Jail, which is a very moving place where they were imprisoned. In the churchyard of Greyfriars, where once the monastery of the Franciscans had stood, a new resting ground of the dead in Henderson's time and Warriston's, although already it held the grave of George Buchanan, The covenant was signed. It is today a romantic spot in the most romantic town in the world. 2.5 centuries ago, it must have been even more picturesque, for from its slope the view was unbroken over the wide space of the grass market, that's where so many of God's people were put to death, to the crags of the castle. But the crowds who gathered to it on this 28th of February, 1638, had neither the leisure nor the inclination to admire their natural surroundings. They came from every lowland county of Scotland, and there were not wanting representatives from the remoter shires beyond the Tay, that means up north, in the Highlands. It is said that there were 60,000 persons in all. Unconsciously, the number was perhaps somewhat exaggerated. The great nobles, the lesser barons, the ministers, the burgesses, the common people. From early morning they had been hurrying to the chosen meeting place. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon inside the church, the solemnity commenced. The Earl of Loudoun, famed for his eloquence, addressed the densely packed congregation. After him, Alexander Henderson offered up fervent prayer. Then Archibald Johnson lifted the fair parchment above an elm in square, which sometimes has been designated the constellation upon the back of Ares, for it was on a splendid ramskin that the covenant had been inscribed. He read its contents clearly and firmly so that all could hear. When this was done, the Earl of Rothes called for objectors, but who in the ardent multitude had come to object? Then in every corner of the church, right hands were uplifted, and the oath to keep the bond was sworn, and many cheeks were wet with weeping. The process of subscribing followed. Inside the walls it went forward hour after hour. Some wrote after their autograph, "Until death." Upholding Christ's crown and covenant, Christ as the head of the church, not the king. Interesting thought when we've got this coronation coming up. Some did draw their own blood and used it in place of ink. When at length the ramskin was carried out to the churchyard, evening had set in after the short spring day, but the people, waiting there excited and expectant, could not be satisfied until many of them, too, had appended their names. There are flat tombstones close beside the building, on one or other of which the parchment must have been spread. It was near 8 ere the work was over and the crowds dispersed. And this was simply the first step. When the transaction in Greyfriars was ended, the covenant had still thousands of adherents to win. In a few weeks it became very apparent that it was indubitably the symbol of the nation's will. Noblemen and gentlemen conveyed copies of the pregnant deed from district to district, from town to town, from village to village. The ministers explained and commended its sentences from well-nigh all the pulpits of the land. Virtually the whole of Scotland signed it, the two notable exceptions being the episcopal capital of St. Andrews and the city of Aberdeen. Aberdeen, which the young Marquis of Montrose, who was a terrible persecutor of God's people, soon to be protagonist for the king, vainly attempted to coerce into acquiescence. Those on the other side stood against the triumphant march of the movement. Now and then they tried to disparage it, as if it had no real spontaneity, but was fed and fostered by domineering leaders. "If you knew," one of these opponents wrote, in April, to a friend at court, "what odd, uncouth, insolent, and ridiculous courses they use to draw in silly, ignorant fools, fearful facets, women and boys, I can hardly say whether it would afford His Majesty more occasion of laughter or anger." But the uprising was no product of compulsion and imperious management. It was the unforced and resolute answer of the Scottish race to Canterbury and Whitehall. The answer was one in which patriotism and religion were blended. It was the protest of an indomitable people against the curtailment of political right and freedom too dear to lose. It was the declaration also on the part of a church which loved intelligently its own simplicities of creed and worship, that it could not tolerate the imposition of forms which it hated and from which not so long before it had, by a mighty effort, emancipated itself. Scotland was heartily willing to acknowledge Charles, to fight his battles and to give him her unstinted allegiance, but he must not filch from her either her civic liberty or her spiritual birthright. If he touched these treasures, he would find her humour thwarteous indeed, and he was certain to confront a will yet more decided than his own. The outlook for the king's party did not brighten as the months wore on. When we halt next in the Cathedral of Glasgow to watch the doings of the Assembly, which held its meetings within the stately shrine, we discover that the cause of presbytery has advanced by leaps and bounds. For a full month from the 21st of November to the 20th of December in the same year which witnessed the signing of the covenant, the Glasgow Assembly was in session. Charles had most reluctantly granted the ministers his permission to come together. So long as he was able, he fought against the request of the nation. Through the whole of the summer and autumn, one obstructive device after another was grasped at by the court, up to London and back to Edinburgh. The Marquis of Hamilton, who was the King's delegate, had journeyed again and again. But nothing except the Assembly would please the people, and in the end the Sovereign gave way. In August, letters of direction were sent by the leaders in Edinburgh to the 53 presbyteries of the country, and even to all the Kirk sessions, containing explicit instructions as to the representatives who ought to be elected. As we're thinking at the moment about the Church of England being corrupted, we think here of the people of Scotland having episcopacy forced upon them, which was a doorway to popery, and them being staunchly Presbyterian, these being hard-won rights and freedoms from the Reformation. We think about how God might be preparing people now for a time of persecution and trouble and difficulty, but the important thing, coming out of a corrupt church. As far as might be, the tares must be excluded from the wheat field of Christ. At length everything was ready. There were 144 ministers and 96 lay members, some of these last the highest noblemen in the land. Rothes and Lothian and Cassillis and Eglintoune and Montrose and Weems and Home, and besides those who were thus commissioned to speak and act, we must think of the vast concourse of interested spectators. During the 4 weeks when the Assembly was busy at its epoch-making tasks, Glasgow had a great addition to its resident population of 12,000 souls. No one gives us a more lifelike account of the occurrences of these weeks than Robert Bailey, the vivacious letter-writer of the Covenant, and the trouble occasioned by the thronging crowds is among the themes on which he descants. Quote, "The magistrates with their tune guard, the noblemen with the assistance of the gentry, whiles the commissioner in person could not get us entry to our rooms, use what force, what policy they could, without such delay of time and trumbling through as they did grieve and offend us." End quote. Nor were the manners of the onlookers all that could be wished. "It is here alone," the minister of Kilwinning is constrained to confess, "where I think we might learn from Canterbury, yea, from the Pope, from the Turks or pagans, at least their deep reverence in the house they call God's ceases, not till it have led them to the adoration of the timber and stones of the place. It is so far the other way that our rascals, without shame, in great numbers make such din and clamour in the house of the true God, that if they minted to use the like behaviour in my chamber, I could not be content till they were down the stairs." Now and then it was a sadly turbulent auditory which the High Church housed that memorable winter. Two figures are prominent in the story of the meeting. One is the moderator, Alexander Henderson of Lucas. Until he was upwards of 50 years of age, he was the studious and hard-working minister of his quiet country parish. It was the urgency of the national crisis which drew him from obscurity, but when he stepped into the arena of public affairs, his commanding powers and unfailing sagacity made him the captain of the church. He was little of stature, with a pensive face. One would scarcely guess from the exterior of the man what wisdom and what courage resided within. "Every knight," said Tristram of Arthur, "we may learn to be a knight of him." And Dixon and Rutherford and Kant and Rollock had the same tribute to pay to Henderson. "He was," Bailey wrote, "incomparably the ablest man of us for all for all things, in every strait and conflict. It is Professor Masson's testimony that he had to be appealed to, and came in at the last as the man of supereminent composure, comprehensiveness, and breadth of brow. We do not wonder that, instinctively and unanimously, he was summoned to the presidency of the Glasgow Assembly." The other figure is different. It is that of the Royal Commissioner, the Marquis of Hamilton. His portrait has been drawn for us by the friendly hand of Bishop Burnet, and even when we have allowed for the partialities of an apologist, it remains a courtly and gracious portrait. An unclouded serenity dwelt always on his looks, and discovered him ever well pleased. One advantage he had beyond all he engaged with in debating, that he was never fretted nor exasperated, and spake at the same rate without clamouring or eagerness. His tones, like those of Christina Rosses, Princess, were modulated just so much as it was meet, and these were valuable assets in the convoy who was sent to propitiate the militant theologians of his native country. A clinging pathos, too, haunts the person of the ill-fated soldier who, rather more than 10 years after his experiences in Glasgow, laid down his head on the block for his kingly master. On the scaffold he bore himself as bravely as Charles had done. When he was desired to change the posture he stood in, since the sunshine full in his face, he answered pleasantly, "No, it would not burn it," and he hoped to see a brighter sun than that very speedily. But with all his winning qualities, there was nothing impressive about the Marquis. His abilities were superficial. He had neither much depth of character nor much strength of will. His mother, one of the most zealous ladies of the Covenant, was endowed with immeasurably more spirit than her son. It might have been predicted beforehand that, in conflict with Alexander Henderson, the Commissioner was destined to defeat. The defeat came a week after the Assembly met. On the morning of the 28th of November, the King's spokesman, who had been challenging the conduct of the members ever since they convened, addressed them for the last time. He objected to the presence of the lay elders, the influence of many of whom Charles greatly dreaded. Were they all, he asked sarcastically, fit to judge of the high and deep mysteries of predestination, of the universality of redemption, of the sufficiency of grace, given or not given to all men, of the resistibility of grace, of total and final perseverance or apostasy of the saints, of the antilapsarian or postlapsarian opinion, of election and reprobation? Still more decisively he denied the right which the Assembly claimed and which it was resolved to exercise of passing sentence on the bishops. The citations commanding the prelates to appear at its bar had been read in the pulpits of the country, which is not usual in this church, and moreover men pledged to the assertions of the Covenant never could deal fairly with the representatives of episcopacy. Quote, "Whoever heard of such judges as have sworn themselves parties," end quote. If the dogged Presbyterians in front of him intended to persevere in their determination, the Commissioner declared with tears which drew water from many eyes, that he must leave the Assembly and must pronounce it dissolved and its enactments invalid and worthless. "Yes," the moderator replied, unruffled and tranquil, "they had no choice but to remain until their duty was done." So the Marquis passed out of the cathedral and next day issued his proclamation, ordering every person who was not resident in Glasgow to depart from the city within 24 hours. But unperturbed by the proclamation, the members of Assembly sat on and pursued their work to its completion. The victory in the duel rested with Henderson, who went all this while for a quiet and calm-spirited man. Lord wrote in a letter of condolence to Hamilton, but who hath showed himself a most violent and passionate man, and a moderator without moderation. And the Lord was the enemy, of course. Yeah, as a slur. The walls of Jericho, as this intrepid Joshua of the Scottish Church phrased it, were pulled down with a thoroughness which satisfied the Israel of the Covenant. The acts of previous assemblies ratifying episcopacy were annulled. The service book and the canons and the Court of High Commission and the Articles of Perth were swept away. 8 of the bishops were excommunicated and the other 6 were deposed or suspended. The National Covenant was confirmed. On the ruins of the prelacy, which Scotland found so distasteful, the fabric of Presbyterianism rose again, fair and strong. As we're coming up in a couple of weeks' time to, in fact, less than a couple of weeks, in a week's time to the meeting of GAFCON in Rwanda, we wonder if something very similar, the deposing, suspending and excommunicating of bishops will take place by a group of God's people there. We don't know what's going to happen, but we know that we're also living in historic times. GAFCON being the Global Anglican Future Conference, those Christians in the Church of England who are very concerned about what's going on and the almost Nicolaitan heresies that are coming in. On the ruins of the prelacy, which Scotland found so distasteful, the fabric of Presbyterianism rose again, fair and strong. Close upon 5 years have passed, years crowded with stirring events, with plots and counterplots, with rumours of battle and actual unsheathings of the sword. When we pause next in our hasty survey, the English Civil War is in progress, and King Charles and his Parliament have abandoned their wordy quarrels for strenuous trump and drum. The time is Monday, the 25th of September, 1643, and the place is St. Margaret's Church at Westminster. There and then, the Solemn League and Covenant was sworn by 220 members of the House of Commons and by the divines of the Greater Westminster Assembly, which had now been deliberating for nearly 3 months. The Solemn League and Covenant, and what was it? Robert Burns sings its eulogy when he declares that it is, quote, sealed freedom's sacred cause, end quote. Robert Burns being the poet of Scotland. Henry Hallam summarises its contents in one long sentence, which yet is admirably clear. The covenant consisted in an oath to be subscribed by all persons in both kingdoms, whereby they bound themselves to preserve the reformed religion in the Church of Scotland, in doctrine, worship, discipline and government, according to the word of God and practice of the best reformed churches, and to endeavour to bring the churches of God in the three kingdoms to the nearest conjunction and uniformity in religion, confession of faith, form of church government, directory for worship and catechising, to endeavour, without respect of persons, the extirpation of popery, prelacy, and whatsoever should be found contrary to sound doctrine and the power of godliness, to preserve the rights and privileges of the parliaments and the liberties of the kingdoms, and the king's person and authority in the preservation and defence of the true religion and liberties of the kingdoms, to endeavour the discovery of incendiaries and malignants who hinder the reformation of religion and divide the king from his people, that they may be brought to punishment, finally, to assist and defend all such as should enter into this covenant, and not suffer themselves to be withdrawn from it, whether to revolt to the opposite party or to give in to a detestable indifference and neutrality. Once we have mastered Hallam's sentence, we understand the aims of the Solemn League. It takes in a wider area than its forerunners, the National Covenant of Scotland. It is anxious for the spiritual prosperity of England and Ireland, no less than for the welfare of their northern neighbour. And how has the enlargement of horizon come about? The explanation is not difficult to find. It is due to the ill success which, in the opening months of the war, attends the parliamentary armies. Reverse after reverse has fallen on their standards. The clouds are massed ominously overhead. It is time, the chiefs in London think, to appeal for aid to the Scots. So a deputation goes to the Convention of Estates in Edinburgh and to the General Assembly in St. Andrews, four members of it from the Commons, of whom young Sir Harry Vane is best known, and two members from the Divines in King Henry the VII's Chapel, Stephen Marshall and Philip Nye. Their petition is successful. So this is Cromwell's armies who are struggling. They secure... Let's check that. This is the parliamentary armies. Yes, that's right, that'll be Cromwell. So, their petition is successful. They secure that Scotland shall not hold aloof from the strife and shall not attempt to mediate between royalist and roundhead, but shall in effect fashion, stretch out a hand of succour to the struggling forces of the parliament. But there must be a formal treaty between the nations. The deputies, Philip Nye, the stout independent, foremost in the argument, would prefer it to be purely political, occupying itself with nothing more than the liberties of the kingdoms. But the Scots, with whom the affairs of the soul and the interests of the cause of God bulk biggest, want something deeper. The English were for a civil league. We are for a religious covenant, writes Robert Bailey. The suppliants from London have to yield the point, and Alexander Henderson, always like William of Deloraine, good at need, draws up the bond. This bond it is, with a few emendations, which is sworn in St. Margaret's, sworn afterwards throughout the length and breadth of England, as well as in the Scotland, where such covenants have their native air and most congenial home. Looking at the Solemn League and at its Scottish predecessor, what judgment shall we pronounce upon them? It will be strange if we do not admit that the ends which they sought were sublime and sacred. Above all things else, their framers desired the victory of true religion in the land. No doubt it was one particular variety of religion which most of these high-thoughted men were eager to have rooted and grounded among their fellow citizens, the variety which we know as Calvinistic Presbyterianism. The Solemn League may not insist in so many words that this shall be the system of dogmatic faith and church government to be accepted by England and Ireland, but it was the well-defined goal towards which Henderson and his comrades panted with zealous hearts. It was no unworthy goal. The Genevan Creed has bred a glorious multitude of stalwart spirits. The Presbyterian Church has been a hearth at which many heroes and saints have gained an enriching nurture. For few grander purposes have men ever banded themselves than for the realisation of the covenanting ideal. The covenanting ideal. Yes, but an oath so lofty, if it is to be valid, must always be voluntary. It must utter the conviction of each person who swears it. It must not be imposed on dubious and wavering souls, and far less on souls unfriendly and hostile. This was one respect in which the Covenanters erred, one mistaken course which showed seeds of weakness in their dedicated ranks. So hungry they were for uniformity in spiritual things, so anxious to see fulfilled the high aspiration of Sir David Lindsay of the Mount, habiter frateres in unum is a blissful thing. One God, one faith, one baptism pure, one law, one land, one king, that they were prepared to coerce their countrymen, if these should be unwilling, into nominal agreement with themselves. The method was wrong. There is none today who will be its advocate, and yet the men themselves were crusaders of Jesus Christ. They wished to have him enthroned over the country, which they loved with more than the patriot's affection. It was his crown which was oriflamme of their holy war. It was the oriflamme of their holy war. For his inalienable rights, his, that's Jesus, inalienable rights, they counted no peril too hazardous and no sacrifice too great. It is easy to accuse them of want of tolerance. We do not pledge ourselves now to the extirpation of any form of religious belief. Our minds are too hospitable and Catholic with a small c. But with one or two inspiring exceptions, the men of the 17th century, whatever their opinion and church, showed none of the modern comprehensiveness. Oliver Cromwell had it among the Independents, and Jeremy Taylor amongst Episcopalians. But how many agreed with them? The Liberty of Prophesying was published 4 summers after the solemnity in St. Margaret's. It advocated the admission to Christian fellowship of everyone who from the heart could repeat the Apostles' Creed. It suggested no more stringent and elaborate test. Few forget the beautiful apologue with which it concludes. How one evening Abraham sat at his tent door, waiting to entertain strangers, and saw coming to him a weary old man who was 100 years of age. How he provided supper for him, but when the wayfarer asked no blessing on his meat and acknowledged himself a fire worshipper, the patriarch in his zeal thrust him out of the tent and exposed him to all the evils of the darkness. How then God rebuked Abraham? I have suffered him these 100 years, although he dishonoured me, and couldst not thou endure him for one night, when he gave thee no trouble? And so Abraham fetched the stranger back, and lodged him kindly, and lavished on him the wisest instruction. The Covenanters would have detected in the apologue a detestable indifference and neutrality, but so would 9 out of every 10 of their compatriots. The era of broad-mindedness had not dawned when they climbed their uphill road, and after all there is something to be urged on behalf of their uncompromising assertion of principle. Persecution is indefensible and shameful. It is both a blunder and a sin, but men should be fully persuaded in their own minds and ready to give a sufficient reason for the faith which is in them. There is a poor and pitiful tolerance as well as a tolerance which is magnanimous and godlike, a pseudo-charity which is not careful to search out the truth, that it may rejoice in it, a shallowness and a cowardice which are destitute of convictions of any sort, and too nerveless to say, "Stand thou on that side, for on this am I." Nothing should commend the adherence of the covenant to the children of the 20th century more than their wisely balanced love of freedom. They were invincible haters of despotism. There were prerogatives of Parliament and of the people which they would surrender to no one. They could not find room in their polity for a tyrant. But on the other hand, they kept an unbounded loyalty for the monarch, who respected their native and proper rights, not serfs and feudal vassals, but constitutional subjects. That is what they aspired to be. The king's person and authority shall be jealously preserved, they said, if in his turn he preserves the true religion and the liberties of the commonweal. In the Scotland of that day, however, it might be in England, there was nowhere any craving for a republic. There was a universal and even a passionate anxiety to guard the name and fame of Charles. It was he who squandered a heritage of devotion and obedience, which he might have retained to his latest hour. It was because he was a rebel against justice and law that he drove into rebellion those who would have spent their lives to promote his good. Round a scaffold in the Edinburgh marketplace, between the Murcott Cross and the Tron Church, a great multitude is gathered. It is a May afternoon in 1650, and the people have come out to witness the execution of James Graham, Marquis of Montrose, and to hear his last words. In reality, they hear nothing. The sufferer is allowed to address himself only to those who stand closest to him, immediately under the gallows 30 feet high. But they see him die with undismayed face, and with that gay and proud bravado which has always marked the finest gallant in the realm. And then the whole crowd gave a general groan, and it was very observable that even those who at first appeared had bitterly inveighed against him could not now abstain from tears. What has brought the Marquis of Montrose, while he is yet in the early prime of his manhood, to this grim scaffold covered with the black cloth? It is impossible to linger over the incidents of his career, although few histories have such extraordinary fascination. We have seen him with his peers signing the National Covenant in the Greyfriars, and attempting afterwards to school the men of Aberdeen, that unnatural town. I've lived there and preached the gospel there. That unnatural town into acquiescence with its terms. To the end he protested his fidelity to the purely Scottish covenant. It was the solemn league, he said, which angered him, because it pledged the subjects of the state under cover of religion to wrest the regal authority from their king. But his attachment to the popular side never could have been deep. By the summer of 1640, when Charles and the Scots were at war, and when he was himself an officer amongst the Presbyterians, he was in correspondence with the sovereign. Was it because he was displeased that Alexander Leslie had received the supreme command in the army? Or was it that the king, who had not given him at first the notice and regard which he thought due to his quality, was manifestly disposed now to cultivate his friendship? Or was it that he was indignant at the larger respect shown by the Covenanters to Argyll, his hereditary rival? The people looked upon them both. Lord Clarendon writes, "As young men of unlimited ambition, and used to say that they were like Caesar and Pompey, the one would endure no superior and the other would have no equal." Perhaps there was a mingling of all three motives, although the last may well have been the strongest, for Montrose never loved Argyll, and could not brook that he should outdistance him in the race. One way or another it befell that soon King Charles had not a doughtier champion than James Graham. Not a doughtier, for what an astonishing soldier he proved himself. In the records of war there are few leaders of a guerrilla campaign who have achieved so much, or who deserve better to be crowned with the laurel. At a time when in England the royalist cause was travelling rapidly downward, he gained for it in Scotland, with his Highlanders and Irishmen, one amazing success after another. Bloody Graham of Claverhouse, I think he was known. Bloody Claverhouse, because I think that was him. I think we'll see as we read on. At Tippermuir, the onset of the mountaineers was irresistible, and at night 300 Covenanters lay stark on the field. At the Bridge of Dee, his men gave the Gordons by and by to be allies and not foes the broadsword and the butt end of their muskets, and drove them in headlong flight into the streets of Aberdeen. At Inverlochy he humbled all the glory of his great antagonist, and 1,500 of the clansmen of Argyll were slain either in the battle or in the relentless pursuit, which went on for 9 long miles. At Old Erne, at Affert, at Kilsyth, each victory following hard on the heels of its fellow, the best soldiers whom the Scottish estates could send against him were mowed down in battalions and massacred without ruth or regret. In 10 or 11 months, in 1644 and 1645, Montrose crowded marches and surprises and great triumphs sufficient to last most generals for a lifetime. But then the end came. At Philip Hoare in September of the later year, in a district which had no love for the cause he maintained and in which his patrols and scouts could glean little news beforehand, he met David Leslie and was hopelessly vanquished. James Graham indisputably had won the right to make the noblest boast of Sir Peter Hopton in the poem, "I like the straining game of striving well to hold up things that fall, but with whatever preternatural skill the chivalrous game is played, the unavoidable doom descends at last." For rather more than 4 years he was in exile on the continent, in Norway and in Netherlands, and then at the bidding of the second Charles, because in the interval the first had fought his last and kingliest fight, he returned to Scotland to make one endeavour more in defence of that discredited Stuart name, whose bravest standard-bearer he was. But his new master was of meaner nature than the old. He acted the traitor towards his good henchmen. He was parleying with the Covenanters all the while that he encouraged their foremost opponent with valiant and unreal promises. He did not deserve a squire so steadfast. It was to death that Montrose had sailed, death in which shame and glory were strangely united. At Carbisdale, in the Kyle of Sutherland, he was defeated by Colonel Strachan, and after wandering in disguise through the wilds of Assint, he was made prisoner at Ardvreck Castle. They sent him south to Edinburgh, where he was loaded with 100 unmerited insults, bearing himself through all the ignominy with the half-contemptuous courage which friends and foes knew so well. At length, and after the blows he had inflicted and the damage he had done, he could expect nothing else. They condemned him to the gallows of which we have had a glimpse. He arrayed himself for it as he would have done for his wedding. John Nicol, the notary public, was among the eyewitnesses, and this is what he saw. In his doon going fra the tollbooth to the place of execution, he was very richly clad in fine scarlet, laid over with richest silver lace, his hat in his hand, his golden hatband, his stockings of incarnate silk, and his shoes with their ribbons on his feet, and sarcas provident for him with purling about above 10 pund the ellen. All these were provident for him by his friendis, and ain pretty casilk put upon him upon the scaffold, cohen he was hanged. To be short, nothing was deficient to honour his pure carcage, moi beseeming a bridegroom nor a criminal. And thus his death was in consonance with his life. For, to quote Lord Clarendon again, he was not without vanity, but his virtues were much superior, and he well deserved to have his memory preserved and celebrated among the most illustrious persons of the age. One could wish that Neil MacLeod of Assint had surrendered to the kindlier impulses of his soul and had permitted his splendid captive to escape. Assuredly, one could wish that Lord Lorne had kept away from the balconies of Moray House when the cart that carried the Marquis, bareheaded and bound to his seat, was driven up the slope of the Canongate. One almost reverences Bishop Wishart, otherwise by no means very admirable, for his unconquerable affection to his dear patron, Jacobus Montis Rosarum, Martio. It was his little book of Montrose's deeds which the executioner fastened round the sufferer's neck on the scaffold, and are they not fine lines which close his elegy over his stricken hero? And there's some Latin in it, I'm not going to even try to read that. Yet we cannot forget that there are ugly blots on James Graham's escutcheon. In many of the features of his character he was a medieval knight who might have stepped out of the chapters of Sir Thomas Malory. But there was that about him, too, which was far from knightly. The cavalier's ideal of honour has been resolved into the four constituents of courage, loyalty, truthfulness and compassion. In the first two qualities, the Marquis was resplendent. The third, truthfulness seems lacking when we recall his desertion of the covenanting ranks for those of the king, although in this he answered the summons of his real predilections. But of the fourth, the quality of compassion, mercy, the grace of compassion, he showed scarcely a trace. When the blameless king of romance has beaten his enemies, he takes their dead bodies, and these he did do balm and gum with many good gums aromatic, and after did do sere them in 60-fold a severed cloth of sendo, and laid them in chests of lead, because they should not chafe nor savour, and upon all these bodies were set their shields with their arms and banners. No such gleams of human feeling illumine the story of Montrose's campaigns. His victories were followed by a carnage which was frightful. He does not appear to have imposed any check on the sanguinary vindictiveness of his rough hillmen whom he captained. We pity his sore tragedy. We kindle at the recollection of the markman, safe and sure, whom neither force nor fawning could unpin. But if he had been cast in a gentler mould, the great Marquis would have been greater still. 7 months have gone. It is the New Year's Day of 1651. We are in the parish church of Scone, spectators of an event no less memorable than the coronation of His Majesty King Charles II. Robert Douglas has preached a very pertinent, wise, and good sermon from a text in the second book of Kings, and he brought forth the king's son and put the crown upon him, and gave him the testimony, and they made him king, and anointed him. And they clapped their hands, and said, God save the king. And Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king, and the people, that they should be the Lord's people. He has spoken some home truths about the bounds and limits of the monarch's power, how he must not use his strength too unduly, or break his contract with his subjects, how if he does, they will be amply justified in resisting his despotism. Charles, we are told, listens with all appearance of interest. The covenants, national and solemn league, are read to him next and sworn by his lips and subscribed by his hand. So Charles II subscribed to the National League and Covenant. And there are those who argue that the British monarchy, that includes King Charles now, are still bound in perpetuity by the National League and Covenant. And if that's true, that's a really significant thing. And now Archibald, Marquis of Argyll, places the crown on the young man's brow. He will not see his 21st birthday for 5 months yet, and he is presented to receive the homage of his nobles and people. The Earl of Crawford and Lindsay gives him the sceptre, while Argyll conducts him to the throne or chair of state, which has been erected some 6 feet above the floor of the church. As he installs him, the Marquis pronounces the words, "Stand and hold fast, from henceforth, the place whereof you are the lawful and righteous heir by a long and lineal succession of your fathers, which is now delivered unto you by authority of Almighty God." After which Robert Douglas has some additional counsels and warnings to give, and the 20th psalm is sung, and the apostolic benediction ends the service. It is not a transaction on which we can look back with joy or pride. Seldom in history has there been a more conspicuous example of faith unfaithful. Both the prince and the leaders of the covenant were, in this instance, unpardonably in the wrong. Robert Douglas was a man of public spirit and of profound religion. But when one asks whether Alexander Henderson, whose voice has been stilled in death nearly 5 years before, would have helped Charles II to his kingdom, the answer must be no. Very keenly the Scots had resented the execution of Charles I. It snapped the ties which united them with the Parliament of England. With few exceptions, it made them the adherents of the martyred sovereign's son. Within a week of his father's death, they proclaimed him in Edinburgh King of Great Britain, France, and Ireland. Twice over, in the months which succeeded, they sent embassies across the German Ocean to treat with him. At first, he and they could not come to terms. It was hard for him, being what he was, to promise obedience to the covenants. It was hard, though it should have been, infinitely harder to part with Montrose, whom the Scottish Parliament had outlawed and the Scottish Assembly had excommunicated. There were royalist noblemen in his retinue who urged him to resist demands so drastic. There was the Queen Mother, of more decided character than himself, who sent message after message adjuring him never to trammel himself with vows and oaths repugnant to them both, and never to abandon the followers whose sympathies were identical with his own. Moreover, he had the hope that among the Irish Catholics, rather than among dour and precise Presbyterians, he might find the deliverers he needed. So the commissioners, to their great discomfort and grief, had to kiss his hands and say their farewells. It were all the pities in the world, but he were in good company, wrote Robert Bailey. Who was one of them? He is one of the most gentle, innocent, well-inclined princes, so far as yet appears, that lives. A trim person, and of a manly carriage, understands pretty well, speaks not much. Would God he were amongst us. But Oliver Cromwell and his soldier saints soon dispelled the vain dream of help from Ireland, and when the Scots returned, Charles was willing to promise them all. We have seen how, playing a double part with that cool heartlessness of which afterwards he was to furnish many proofs, he had meanwhile sent his best paladin to a cruel death. What price would he not pay to win back his throne? Then in June 1650 he embarked at Haersleidaik. On the 23rd of the month, outside the mouth of the Spey, he swore that, in every clause and syllable, he would keep the covenants. John Livingstone, who was among the representatives of the Kirk, heard indeed that the king is minded to speak some words, that his oath should not import any infringement of the laws of England. But he was at once answered that not a single modifying expression would be tolerated, and he performed anything that could have been required, yet without any evidence of any real change of heart. So he swore the covenant, but he didn't believe it. And why did men to whom the fear of the Lord was the beginning of wisdom countenance the hollow mockery and imposture so fateful and perilous? Why did they, as Livingstone phrases it, take the plague of God to Scotland? If Charles's honesty was gone, theirs for the moment was sacrificed too. There is no room here to recount the crookedness which ensued. At the bidding of his monitors, he confessed his sorrow for his father's errors and his mother's idolatry. His life became a weariness, so continually and so closely he was watched. Perhaps in heart he rejoiced as much as Oliver did over the rout of the Covenanters at Dunbar, although he declared in sentences veneered with piety that the stroke and trial is very hard to be borne. Once he made an effort to extricate himself from his bondage, the futile effort which is known in Scottish history as the Start. We can scarcely wonder that, through all his subsequent life, his hostility against Kirk and Covenant was of the most unforgiving sort. Then came the coronation scene at Scone, and afterwards, for 8 months, he had the simulacrum of royalty until Worcester fight dissolved the thin phantom, and again Charles was in exile. The lover of the Covenanters longs with his whole soul that they had not demeaned themselves to traffic with the godless prince. Loyalty prompted them, but they knew that he was unworthy of their loyalty. He gave them his solemn and reiterated assurances that not only had he the honour and civil liberties of the land to defend, but religion against Kirk and religion. The gospel and the covenant against which hell shall not prevail. But they felt that in the assurances there was no single grain of truth. They were angry with Cromwell and his doings, but their anger should never have conducted them to this heart-wounding hypocrisy. It is a chapter which their friends would fain erase from their radiant and quickening annals. For if the crimes of the bad are certain to yield a plentiful harvest of evil, the crimes of the good are unspeakably more mischievous and mournful. The retribution came quickly. In large measure, it was because of these dallyings and intrigues with Charles that the covenanting ranks were for a time to be cleft asunder by a melancholy quarrel, the quarrel between resolutioner and remonstrant or protester. The trouble reached its height in the General Assembly of 1651, held at St. Andrews and Dundee. There the resolutioners were in the ascendant, and nothing would content them but the deposition of their three most active opponents, James Guthrie of Stirling, Patrick Gillespie of Glasgow, and James Simpson of Erith. If the Presbyterian Church had gained a king, whose word no man relied on, it was sending adrift some of its most valiant sons. The exchange tended wholly to its own impoverishment and loss. In large measure, the strife arose out of the entanglement with the chief malignant, yet it had its roots further back, and a momentary retrospect becomes necessary. In the closing hours of 1647, within the walls of Carisbrook Castle, Charles I had been closeted with certain Scottish noblemen, and had signed with them the bargain which history styles the engagement. It promised on the king's side that the solemn league and covenant should be confirmed by Parliament, and that presbytery should be established in the country for a period of 3 years, at the end of which term a definite settlement of the religious question was to be made. On the other side, there were stipulations that the covenant should not be forced upon those who did not like it, and that, within the royal household, the episcopal forms of worship should remain unchallenged. It was, in consequence of this bargain, that the Duke of Hamilton, whom as Marquis we saw contending with the Glasgow Assembly, led into England on his master's behalf that army of raw and undisciplined troopers on which Cromwell inflicted the bitterest chastisement at Preston. But the church never approved of the engagement, nor did the stricter of the covenanting peers, who after Hamilton's hapless venture found themselves again at the helm of affairs. So, early in 1649, the Act of Classes was passed. It was an endeavour to bar the Canaanite outside the House of Lords, outside the House of the Lord. It declared that there were persons who had unfitted themselves for occupying places of trust and power, four classes of them, of whom the thoroughgoing Royalists and Episcopalians were one, and the lukewarm Covenanters who had promoted the engagement were another. For life, for 10 years, for 5 years, for 2 years, these classes were to be excluded from office, and thus, as one of the Puritan statesmen who defended the act put the matter in a vigorous metaphor, the teeth of the malignants were broken. But dragon's teeth have a troublesome habit of reappearing, sometimes in aggravated size and terribleness. Scarcely had the Act of Classes become law when Scotland heard, with a shudder, that the king had gone to his doom. The negotiations with his son followed, and Cromwell's invasion and the catastrophe of Dunbar, the Scottish Parliament took fright. Desirable as it might be to enlist in the service of the country those alone whose shields, like that of Edmund Spenser's hero, were formed of one diamond, perfect, pure and clean, there was claimant need that the regiment of her defenders should be largely and immediately reinforced, and new helpers could not be found except among the men who had been tainted and disqualified so brief a time before. The Parliament determined to welcome these men back. In June 1651 it rescinded the Act of Classes, and the Assembly of the Church, meeting in the next month, ratified the decision of the legislators. It framed its public resolutions for bringing in the malignant party first to the army and then to the judicatories. There were some who protested, however, clinging fast to the older and austerer method of fighting God's battles with none but God's soldiery. They had short shrift, as we have noted, from their brethren. These were the protesters or remonstrants, and those who carried things their own way and deposed the dissentients were the resolutioners. When Charles, the roof and crown of malignancy itself, had been rehabilitated and enthroned, it was inevitable that some such relaxation as that adopted by Parliament and Assembly should come. It will be granted, too, that in the parlous state of the nation's fortunes, the resolutioners had cogent reasons to allege in their defence. It was difficult to reject good fighters merely because they abhorred the covenant or held fellowship with men who did. But the protesters could claim the greater consistency. The cause committed to them was sacred even more emphatically than political, and they felt that its lustre would be tarnished if they entrusted it to unworthy hands. Only his reproachless servants should bear the vessels of the King of Kings. They might not be careful enough to speak the truth in love. Samuel Rutherford and Patrick Gillespie were but too human in the hotness of their tempers, but theirs was the better part. The more straightforward policy, the higher road, and if the Assembly condemned them, they had but to turn to their congregations, and they were surrounded by disciples and friends. So lamentable the breach became that the church was practically rent in two, and for a number of years the protester had communion with none but the protester, the resolutioner simply with his fellow resolutioner. Ephraim distrusted Judah, and Judah vexed Ephraim. The divergence revealed itself in other matters than the discussion of military and civic appointments. The resolutioner, Robert Douglas, or Robert Blair, or Robert Bakel, or David Dixon, preached and conducted public worship in a mode distinguishable from that favoured by some in the rival party. He was more methodical and systematic, colder and statelier than the evangelical and enthusiastic protester. Bailey, for instance, had scant patience with the few heady men who waste our church. Trained in the Orthodox school of Dutch divinity, having spent his youth in doing battle against Arminians and Antinomians, he entertained a wholesome dread of all novelties in pulpit or pew. Speaking of Andrew Gray of Glasgow, he says, "He has the new guise of preaching which Mr. Hugh Binning and Mr. Robert Layton began, contemning the ordinary way of exponing and dividing a text, of raising doctrines and uses, but runs out in a discourse on some common head, in a high, romancing, unscriptural style, tickling the ear for the present, and moving the affections in some, but leaving, as he confesses, little or naught to the memory or and understanding. Even the tones of voice which, as it seemed to him, the protester assumed as evidence and expression of his devotedness, offended our staid and custom-bound divine. The man's vehemency in his prayer, a strange kind of sighing, the like whereof I had never heard as a pythonizing out of the belly of a second person, made me amazed. Robert Bailey himself, learned, good, honourable, never offended against the proprieties, nor was much troubled with vehemency." Lord Jones would have said that vehemency is what makes preaching. "Shall we take an illustration of the varying accents of resolutioner and remonstrant? Here are some sentences from the Sum of Saving Knowledge, a little book which is no ignoble sample of the more precise and less impassioned theology. Let the penitent desiring to believe reason thus: what doth suffice to convince all the elect may suffice to convince me also. But what the Spirit has said suffices to convince the elect world. Therefore, what the Spirit hath said serveth to convince me therefore also. Whereupon, let the penitent, desiring to believe, take with him words, and say heartily to the Lord, seeing thou sayest, seek ye my face, my soul answereth to thee, thy face will I seek. I have hearkened unto the offer of an everlasting covenant of all saving mercies to be had in Christ. I do heartily embrace thy offer. Lord, let it be a bargain. Thus may a man be made an unfeigned believer in Christ. It may be irrefragable, but is it not too icily regular, too statuesque and syllogistic? The soul in its agony craves something simpler, more vital, fuller of the strong consolations of God. But now let us hearken to Hugh Binning, the protester on whose new guise of preaching Bailey looked with a frown. He that is in earnest about this question, how shall I be saved? I think he should not spend the time in reflecting on and examining of himself till he finds something promising in himself, but from discovered sin and misery pass straightway over to the grace and mercy of Christ, without any intervening search of something in himself to warrant him to come. There should be nothing before the eye of the soul but sin and misery and absolute necessity, compared with superabounding grace and righteousness in Christ, and thus it singly devolves itself over upon Christ, and receives him as offered freely. I know it is not possible that a soul can receive Christ till there be some preparatory convincing work of the law, but I hold that to look to any such preparation and fetch an encouragement or motive therefrom to believe in Christ is really to give him a price for his free waters and wine. It is to mix in together Christ and the law in the point of our acceptation. Who is not conscious, when he reads the words, that he is moving in a diviner air? The sentiment is the same as before, but formerly there was a dissonance in uttering it, which grated on the ear, and almost made the music of the gospel harsh. Now the speaker feels no down-dragging influences in his Calvinism,
He does not measure his syllables, lest he should render the grace of God too large and too accessible. He soars away and aloft like the lark. Up in the glory, climbing and ringing, or like the angel of Bethlehem, throbbing with uncontrollable gladness, as he publishes his message, "Behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people." There is a final picture at which we must glance. It is the picture of two personalities that confront each other. Their attitude is that of antagonism. Their tempers are incompatible. They are, for the most part, in undisguised and open strife. The personalities are those of the Covenanter and Oliver Cromwell, the late usurper. It was the Covenanter's customary name for the great God-fearing Englishman after that September day in 1658, when, trusting in the promises which are yea and amen in Christ Jesus, the Lord Protector passed from the world which he had vastly enriched. So we called him the Protector in England, but they called him the usurper in Scotland. We need not wonder at the alienation, however. We must lament its vigour and sharpness. The English government of Scotland, says Dr. Samuel Gardner, was a good example of a government which fails in spite of its excellent intentions and excellent practice, simply because it pays no heed to the spirit of nationality. That's true. The Scots are very different from the English. The English are very different from the Scots. Cromwell stood in many respects at an opposite pole of thinking from the Scots. He was a soldier, and they began to dread that tremendous engine of conquest, the army of the Parliament, which his genius had designed and compacted, and which menaced their independence more overwhelmingly than Charles had ever been able to do. He was a statesman, but he felt none of their stubborn loyalty towards a king, who had perversely thrown away his right to rule, and they could never forgive the regicide, even if they saw clearly enough the ineradicable faults of the prince whom had he helped to lead to the block. He was a man of religion, but they differed radically from him. Oliver signed the Solemn League, it is true, but in his eyes the bond was not the sacred and awful symbol which it was to Presbyterian Scotsmen. He was an independent. He was in favour of a far wider Catholicity and toleration than they could abide. He permitted the growth in his regiments, and by in the Commonwealth, of all manner of sectaries. It was scarcely surprising that they scowled on him, and fought against him, and counted him an enemy rather than a friend. When we recall Dunbar, Drove, and the subsequent marches and countermarches of the Ironsides through a subjugated country, the forcible dismissal, too, of the General Assembly of 1653, vexed and noisy with the strife of tongues, and the refusal in succeeding years to sanction the meeting of the Supreme Court of the Church, we comprehend why Scotland disliked the Puritan captain. Her distrust is more intelligible than that of some others. It has been pointed out that the English peasant of our day, although his ancestors were against the king and helped in the execution of Cromwell's stern policy, abhors Old Noll as if he were an ogre. Old Noll, I presume that's him. Where traces of desecration are visible in a church, where a shattered wall is all that remains of a stately home hallowed by the presence of Gloriana, where an ancient door shows the pattern of bullet marks, Hodge will have it that the mischief is due to the commander and ruler who raised England to the first rank among the nations of Europe. The Scot of the 17th century, although his persevering opposition cannot be justified, had more of reason on his side. There were exceptions, no doubt, in the West. Colonel Strachan and his little company of his followers joined Oliver. Patrick Gillespie sometimes prayed publicly for the Protector. Dumbartonshire and Wigtown accepted the tender of union with England with a degree of enthusiasm, as being the excellent blessing of God, who by a long-continued series of providences seems to hold out this to be his great design for the common good of the people of this island. After the union, belated and yet premature, was proclaimed at the Merket Cross of Edinburgh in the Maytime of 1654, and after General Monk had been feasted at a banquet, which was 6 days in preparing, throughout the baileys did stand and serve the whole time, something like that. It's called Scots. A few Scotsmen sat in Cromwell's parliaments. But the country as a whole was unfriendly, and the church, hating that motley troop of sects she saw overspreading England, was more critical still. As for the Kirkmen and their vassals, we read in a newsletter sent from Edinburgh on the 27th of December 1651, they retain their old rugged obstinacy and currish behaviour. Yet the strong and stable discipline of Cromwell was an untold blessing to these censorious Kirkmen. The Scotland of the years of the Commonwealth had its grave moral blemishes. There were prominent and repulsive national sins, then as now. There was no little superstition, as we may learn from the hideous story of how the witches were persecuted and done to death. But side by side with the painfuller features of the period, there were the blossom and the fruitage of genuine religion. Then, writes good James Kirkton, was Scotland a heap of wheat set about with lilies, uniform, or a palace of silver beautifully proportioned, and this seems to me to have been Scotland's high noon. On a later page he expands and explains his panegyric of the golden season, round which the shades of the prison house closed all too early. At the king's return, every parish had a minister, every village had a school, every family almost had a Bible. Yea, in most of the country, all the children of age could read the scriptures. Every minister was obliged to preach thrice a week, to lecture and catechise once, besides other private duties wherein they abounded, according to their proportion of faithfulness and abilities. None of them might be scandalous in their conversation or negligent in their office, so long as a presbytery stood, and among them were many holy in conversation and eminent in gifts. In many places the Spirit seemed to be powered out with the word, both by the multitude of sincere converts, and also by the common work of reformation upon many who never came the length of a communion. There were no fewer than 60 aged people, men and women, who went to school, that even then they might be able to read the scriptures with their own eyes. I have lived many years in a parish where I have never heard an oath. Let me try walking through Hull today, and you'll hear almost nothing but by the time you get to the other side of the city. And you might have rid many miles before you had heard any. Also, you could not for a great part of the country have lodged in a family where the Lord was not worshipped by reading, singing, and public prayer. Nobody complained more of our church government than our taverners, whose ordinary lamentation was their trade was broke. People would become so sober. And the man who more than any other helped to secure for the land this Sabbatism of restful godliness was misunderstood, resisted, denounced. It is one of the pathetic contradictions of which history provides many an example.